we take you to winter 1776.
Message for General Washington.
Yes, Captain.
Oh, hello, sir. Colonel Lee says the Redcoats are encamped just across the river at Trenton, sir.
We need to get the boats down to the Delaware, but the wagons are too noisy. What to do?
Begging the General's pardon, sir, Eustace Emery III, and I can lube those wagon axles so they don't squeak, sir.
Do it, Sergeant Emery.
And so, Washington's army crossed the Delaware.
We can grease your modern car truck axles, change the oil, charge the air conditioning, and do brakes, belts, and hoses on all brands, foreign and domestic. If you want a mechanic that cares about your car and your Thanksgiving, call 323-8650. That's 323-8650 and perfectionautoworks.com.
This is Professor John McElroy, founding host of America's Fabric, a program about the cultural beliefs and foundations of our exceptional country. The program you're about to hear will help connect those beliefs and foundations to today's society. Here's your host for today.
Good morning, I'm Charles Heller, and I'll be your host for America's Fabric. The purpose of America's Fabric is to talk about America's culture and relate America's culture and political beliefs as it was formed to the modern day and explain why those beliefs are still relevant and valid today. And I'm going to be talking about an article by David B. Koppel, who is a scholar and an attorney and has been involved in a lot of Second Amendment cases. He talks about the roots of the Second Amendment and why they're still valid today. And his article is entitled The American Revolution Against British Gun Control. This article reviews the British gun control program that precipitated the American Revolution, the 1774 import ban on firearms and gunpowder, the 1774 to 75 confiscations of firearms and gunpowder, and the use of violence to effectuate the confiscations. It was these events that changed a situation of political tension into an actual shooting war. Each of these British abuses provides insights into the scope of the modern Second Amendment. Furious at the December 1773 Boston Tea Party, Parliament in 1774 passed the Coercive Acts. The particular provisions were offensive to Americans, but it was the possibility that the British might deploy the army to enforce them that primed many colonists for armed resistance. The Patriots of Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, resolved that in the event of Great Britain attempting to force unjust laws upon us by the strength of arms, our cause we leave to heaven and our rifles, unquote. A South Carolina newspaper essay, reprinted in Virginia, urged that any law that had to be enforced by the military was necessarily illegitimate. The Royal Governor of Massachusetts, General Thomas Gage, had forbidden town meetings from taking place more than once a year, when he dispatched the Redcoats to break up an illegal town meeting in Salem. 3,000 armed Americans appeared in response, and the British retreated. Gage's aide, John Andrews, explained that everyone in the area aged 16 or older owned a gun and plenty of gunpowder. Military rule would be difficult to impose on an armed populace. Gage had only 2,000 troops in Boston. There were thousands of armed men in Boston alone and more in the surrounding area. One response to the problem was to deprive the Americans of their gunpowder. Large quantities of black powder were often stored in a town's powder house. The powder house would hold merchants' reserves, large quantities stored by individuals, as well as powder for use by the local militia. Although colonial laws generally required militia, and sometimes all householders too, to have their own firearm and a minimum quantity of powder, not everybody could afford it. Consequently, the government sometimes supplied public arms and powder to individual militiamen. Before dawn on September 1, 1774, 260 of Gage's redcoats sailed up the Mystic River and seized hundreds of barrels of powder from the Charlestown Powder House. The powder alarm, as it became known, was a serious provocation. By the end of the day, 20,000 militiamen had mobilized and started marching towards Boston. The message was unmistakable. If the British used violence to seize arms or powder, the Americans would treat that violent seizure as an act of war and would fight. And that is exactly what happened several months later on April 19, 1775. 5 days after the powder alarm, on September 6th, the militia of the towns of Worcester County assembled on the Worcester Common. Backed by the formidable array, the Worcester Convention took over the reins of government and ordered the resignations of all militia officers who had received their commissions from the royal governor. The officers promptly resigned and then received new commissions from the Worcester Convention. That same day, the people of Suffolk County, which includes Boston, assembled and adopted the Suffolk Resolves. The 19-point resolves took control of the local militia away from the royal governor by replacing the governor's appointed officers with officers elected by the militiamen themselves. The First Continental Congress, which just assembled in Philadelphia, unanimously endorsed the Suffolk Resolves and urged all other colonies to send supplies to help the Bostonians. Governor Gage directed the Redcoats to begin general, warrantless searches for arms and ammunition. What most irritated the people was seizing their arms and ammunition. On October 26, 1774, the Massachusetts Provincial Congress adopted a resolution condemning military rule and criticizing General Gage for unlawfully seizing and retaining large quantities of ammunition in the arsenal at Boston. The Provincial Congress urged all militia companies to organize and elect their own officers. At least a quarter of the militia, the famous Minutemen, were directed to equip and hold themselves in readiness to march at the shortest notice. The Provincial Congress further declared that everyone who did not already have a gun should go get one and start practicing with it diligently. In flagrant defiance of royal authority, the Provincial Congress appointed a committee of safety and vested it with the power to call forth the militia. The militia of Massachusetts was now the instrument of what was becoming an independent government of Massachusetts. Lord Dartmouth, the Royal Secretary of State for America, sent Gage a letter on October 17, 1774, urging him to disarm the New Englanders. Gage replied that he'd like to do so, but it was impossible without the use of force. After Gage's letter was made public by a reading in the British House of Commons, it was publicized in America as proof of Britain's malignant intentions. Gee whiz, disarming the populace is a malignancy. Gee, where did we get that idea? 2 days after Lord Dartmouth dispatched his disarmament recommendation, King George III and his ministers blocked importation of arms and ammunition to America. Read literally, the order merely required a permit to export arms or ammunition from Great Britain to America. But in practice, no permits would be granted. Meanwhile, Benjamin Franklin was masterminding the surreptitious import of arms and ammunition from the Netherlands, France, and Spain. The patriotic Boston Committee of Correspondence learned of the arms embargo and promptly dispatched Paul Revere to New Hampshire with the warning that two British ships were headed to Fort William and Mary, near Portsmouth, New Hampshire, to seize firearms, cannons, and gunpowder. On December 14, 1774, 400 New Hampshire patriots preemptively captured all the material at the fort. In Parliament, a moderate minority favored conciliation with America. Among the moderates was the Duke of Manchester, who warned that America now had 3 million people, and most of them were trained to the use of arms. He was certain they would produce a stronger army than Great Britain could. What he's saying is the most powerful army in the world at the time, the Redcoats, would be overcome by a bunch of civilians. That's what he was really saying. Massachusetts also urged American gunsmiths to, quote, diligently to apply themselves to making guns for everyone who did not already have a gun, unquote. A few weeks earlier, the Congress had resolved that it be strongly recommended to all inhabitants of this colony to be diligently attentive to learning the use of arms, unquote. The ideology underlying all forms of American resistance was explicitly premised on the right of self-defense of all inalienable rights. From the Self-Defense Foundation was constructed a political theory in which the people were the masters and the government the servant, so that the people have the right to remove a disobedient servant. The British government was not, in a purely formal sense, attempting to abolish the American common law right of self-defense. Yet in practice, that was precisely what the British were attempting to do. First, by disarming the Americans, the British were attempting to make the practical exercise of the personal right of self-defense much more difficult. Second, the Americans made no distinction between self-defense against a lone criminal or against a criminal government. To the Americans, and to their British Whig ancestors, the right of self-defense necessarily implied the right of armed self-defense against a tyrant or against the tyrant's tyranny. The troubles in New England inflamed the other colonies. Patrick Henry's great speech to the Virginia legislature on March 23, 1775, argued that the British plainly meant to subjugate America by force. Because every attempt by the Americans at peaceful reconciliation had been rebuffed, the only remaining alternatives for the Americans were to accept slavery or to take up arms. If the Americans did not act soon, the British would soon disarm them, and all hope of ever resisting would be lost. Quote, "The millions of people armed in the holy cause of liberty, and in such a country as that which we possess, are invincible by any force our enemy could send against us," he promised. The convention formed a committee, including Patrick Henry, Richard Henry Lee, George Washington, and Thomas Jefferson, to, quote, "prepare a plan for the embodying, arming, and disciplining of such a number of men as may be sufficient to defend the Commonwealth," unquote. The convention urged that, quote, "every man be provided with a good rifle, and that every horseman be provided with pistols and holsters, a carbine, or other firelock," unquote. When the Virginia militiamen assembled a few weeks later, many wore canvas hunting shirts adorned with the motto, "Liberty or Death." In South Carolina, patriots established a government headed by the General Committee. The committee described the British arms embargo as a plot to disarm the Americans in order to enslave them. Thus, the committee recommended that all persons should immediately provide themselves with a large quantity of ammunition. Without formal legal authorization, Americans began to form independent militias outside the traditional chain of command of the royal governors. In Virginia, George Washington and George Mason organized the Fairfax Independent Militia Company. The Fairfax militiamen pledged that, "We will, each of us, constantly keep by us a firelock, 6 pounds of gunpowder, and 20 pounds of lead." Other independent militia embodied in Virginia along the same model. Independent militia also formed in Connecticut, Rhode Island, New Hampshire, Maryland, and South Carolina, choosing their own officers. John Adams praised the newly constituted Massachusetts militia, quote, "commanded through the province, not by men who procured their commissions from a governor as a reward for making themselves pimps to his tools," unquote. And people say we're contentious now, huh? The American War of Independence began on April 19, 1775, when 700 redcoats, under the command of Major John Pitcairn, left Boston to seize American arms at Lexington and Concord. The militia that assembled at the Lexington Green and the Concord Bridge consisted of able-bodied men ages 16 to 60. They supplied their own firearms, although a few poor men had to borrow a gun. Warned by Paul Revere and Samuel Dawes of the British advance, the young women of Lexington assembled cartridges late into the evening of April 18th. At dawn, the British confronted about 200 militiamen at Lexington. "Disperse, you rebels! Damn you! Throw down your arms and disperse!" ordered Major Pitcairn. The Americans were quickly routed. With a huzzah of victory, the redcoats marched on to Concord, where one of Gage's spies had told them that the largest Patriot reserve of gunpowder was stored. At Concord's North Bridge, the town militia met with some of the British force, and after a battle of 2 or 3 minutes, drove off the British. By the way, I've stood on that bridge. It's very moving. Notwithstanding the setback at the bridge, the redcoats had sufficient force to search the town for arms and ammunition, but the main powder stores at Concord had been hauled to safety before the redcoats arrived. When the British began to withdraw back to Boston, things got much, much worse for them. Armed Americans were swarming in from nearby towns. They would soon outnumber the British 2-1. Although some of the Americans cohered in militia units, a great many fought on their own, taking sniper positions wherever opportunity presented itself. Only British reinforcements dispatched all the way from Boston saved the British expedition from annihilation. And the fact that the Americans started running out of ammunition and gunpowder. One British officer reported, quote, "These fellows are generally good marksmen, and many of them used long guns made for duck shooting," unquote. On a per-shot basis, the Americans inflicted much higher casualties than had the British regulars. Part of that was because the British had muskets and the Americans had rifles, muskets being smoothbore and rifles being well-rifled. That night, the American militiamen began laying siege to Boston, where General Gage's standing army was located. At dawn, Boston had been the base from which the king's army could project force into New England. Now it was trapped inside the city, surrounded by people who were literally up in arms and armed with rifles that would shoot 200 yards to their 50 to 75. 2 days later, in Virginia, royal authorities confiscated 20 barrels of gunpowder from the public magazine in Williamsburg and destroyed the public firearms there by removing their firing mechanisms. In response to complaints, manifest most visibly by the mustering of a large independent militia led by none other than Patrick Henry, Governor Dunmore delivered a legal note promising to pay restitution. At Lexington and Concord, forcible disarmament had not worked out very well for the British. So back in Boston, Gage set out to disarm the Bostonians in a different way. On April 23, 1775, General Gage offered the Bostonians the opportunity to leave town if they surrendered their arms. The Boston selectmen voted to accept the offer, and within days, 2,674 guns were deposited, one gun for every two adult male Bostonians. Gee, the first buyback, huh? Gage thought that many Bostonians still had guns, and he refused to allow the Bostonians to leave. Indeed, a large proportion of the surrendered guns were training arms, large muskets with bayonets that would be very, very difficult to hide. After several months, food shortages in Boston convinced Gage to allow easier emigration from the city. Gage's disarmament program incited other Americans to take up arms. Benjamin Franklin, returning to Philadelphia after an unsuccessful diplomatic trip to London, was, quote, highly pleased to find the Americans arming and preparing for the worst events, unquote. The government in London dispatched more troops and three more generals to America, William Howe, Henry Clinton, and John Burgoyne. The generals arrived on May 25, 1775, with orders from Lord Dartmouth to seize all arms in public armories, or which had been secretly collected together for the purposes of aiding rebellion. The war underway, the Americans captured Fort Ticonderoga in upstate New York, and the June 17 Battle of Bunker Hill, the militia held its ground against the British regulars and inflicted heavy casualties on them until they ran out of gunpowder and were finally driven back. Had Gage not confiscated the gunpowder from the Charleston Powder House the previous September, the Battle of Bunker Hill probably would have resulted in an outright defeat of the British. On June 19th, General Gage renewed his demand that the Bostonians surrender their arms, and he declared that anyone found in possession of arms would be deemed guilty of treason, and of course, the punishment for treason then was death by hanging. Meanwhile, the Continental Congress had voted to send 10 companies of riflemen from Pennsylvania, Maryland, and Virginia to aid the Massachusetts militia. On July 6, 1775, the Continental Congress adopted the Declaration of Causes and Necessity of Taking Up Arms, written by Thomas Jefferson and the great Pennsylvania lawyer, John Dickinson. Among the grievances were General Gage's efforts to disarm the people of Lexington, Concord, and Boston. 2 days later, the Continental Congress sent an open letter to the people of Great Britain warning that, quote, men trained to arms from their infancy and animated by love of liberty will afford neither a cheap nor easy conquest, unquote. The Swiss immigrant John Zubli, who was serving as Georgia delegate to the Continental Congress, wrote a pamphlet entitled Great Britain's Right to Tax by a Swiss. He warned that, quote, in a strong sense of liberty and the use of firearms almost from the cradle, the Americans have vastly the advantage over men of their rank almost anywhere else. Indeed, children were shouldering the resemblance of a gun before they were able to walk very well, unquote. He said further, quote, the Americans will fight like men who have everything at stake, and their motto, death or freedom, unquote. The town of Gorham, Massachusetts, now part of the state of Maine, sent the British government a warning that, quote, many of our women have been used to handle the cartridge and load the musket, unquote. Tough Massachusetts women, huh? It was feared that the Massachusetts gun confiscation was the prototype for the rest of America. Guess what, boys? It still is, boys and girls. For example, a newspaper article published in three colonies reported that when the new British generals arrived, they would order everyone in America, quote, to deliver up their arms by a certain stipulated day, unquote. The events of April 19, 1775, convinced many more Americans to arm themselves and to embody independent militia. A report from New York City observed that the inhabitants there are arming themselves, forming companies, and taking every method to defend our rights. The like spirit prevails in the province of New Jersey, where a large and well-disciplined militia was now fit for action, unquote. Boy, I wish that were still true, huh? In New Jersey and New York. In Virginia, Lord Dunmore observed, quote, every county is now arming a company of men who they call an independent company for the avowed purpose of protecting their committee and to be employed against government if the occasion require, unquote. North Carolina's royal governor, Joseph Martin, issued a proclamation outlawing independent militia, but it had little effect. A Virginia gentleman wrote a letter to a Scottish friend explaining in America, quote, we are all in arms, exercising and training old and young to the use of the gun. No person goes abroad without his sword or gun or pistols or all three. Every plane is full of armed men who all wear a hunting shirt on the left breast of which is sewed in very legible letters, liberty or death, unquote. The British then escalated the war. Royal Admiral Samuel Graves ordered that all seaports north of Boston be burned. When the British Navy showed up at what was then known as Falmouth, Massachusetts, today's Portland, Maine, the town attempted to negotiate. The townspeople gave up 8 muskets, which were hardly sufficient, and so Falmouth was destroyed by naval bombardment. The next year, the 13 colonies would adopt the Declaration of Independence. The declaration listed the tyrannical acts of King George III, including his methods for carrying out gun control. Quote, he has plundered our seas, ravaged our coasts, burnt our towns, and destroyed the lives of our people. Unquote. As the war went on, the British always remembered that without gun control, they could never control America. In 1777, with British victory seeming likely, Colonial Undersecretary William Knox drafted a plan entitled, quote, What is Fit to be Done with America? Unquote. To ensure that there would be no future rebellions, the militia laws should be repealed and none suffered to be reenacted, and the arms of all the people should be taken away. Nor should any foundry or manufactory of arms, gunpowder, or any warlike stores be ever suffered in America. Nor should any gunpowder, lead, arms, or ordnance be imported into it without license and severe restriction. Unquote. Sounds kind of like something that might come out of certain senators today. To the Americans, and you know, it's interesting, today the exact same issue is still on the table with so-called ghost guns, the ability for plans to take plans off the internet, put it into a CNC machine, and make your own firearms right in your own garage or workshop. The exact same issues that existed then exist very much presently here and now today. Back to the article. To the Americans of the Revolution and the founding era, the theory of some late 20th century courts that the Second Amendment is a collective right and not an individual right might have seemed incomprehensible. The Americans owned guns individually in their homes. They owned guns collectively in their town armories and powder houses. They would not allow the British to confiscate their individual arms nor their collective arms. And when the British tried to do both, it sparked a revolution. Remember that the igniting event of the American Revolution was an attempt at seizing guns. It was gun control on April 19, 1775, in what was called the shot heard round the world. The Americans used their individual arms and their collective arms to fight against the confiscation of any arms. Americans fought to provide themselves a government that would never perpetuate the abuses that had provoked the very revolution that had started. What are modern versions of such abuses? The reaction against the 1774 import ban for firearms and gunpowder via a discretionary licensing law indicates that most import restrictions are unconstitutional if their purpose is to make it more difficult for Americans to possess guns. The Federal Gun Control Act of 1968 prohibits the import of any firearm that is not deemed sporting by federal regulators. That import ban seems difficult to justify based on the historical record of what would become the United States. Laws disarming people who have proven themselves to be a particular threat to public safety are not implicated by the 1774 to 1776 experience. Laws that aim to disarm the public at large are precisely what turned a political argument into the American Revolution. The most important lesson for today from the Revolution is about militaristic or violent search and seizure in the name of disarmament. As Hurricane Katrina bore down on Louisiana, Police officers in St. Charles Parish confiscated the firearms from people who were attempting to flee. After the hurricane passed, officers went house to house in New Orleans, breaking into homes and confiscating firearms at gunpoint. The firearm seizures were flagrantly illegal under existing state law. Gun ownership simpliciter ought never to be a pretext for government violence. The Americans in 1775 fought a war because the king did not agree with that principle. In Liberty, I'm Charles Heller.
You've been listening to America's Fabric, a program dedicated to the exploration of the founding principles of our exceptional country, why they still matter, and why we are proud to be Americans. This program is listener-supported. To contribute, please go online to americasfabric.org and click the donation button. Or send a check to America's Fabric, P.O. Box 85023, Tucson, Arizona, 85754.